But we're just seeing a short pageant. A devotional time. The meaning is, in all seasons and at all times, Lord, we praise you. You are my father, father, you are my mother, you are my friend, you are my bliss. You are the beginning and the end, you are the light, you are my bliss. It's sung in Kannada, one of the languages of South India. It's number
51. Third second, bhajan number 51, the last one.
We don't have the sheets.
No.
It's too dark.
It's too dark, so we'll make it out with you.
Yella kala dolu yella vele yelu deva ninnane sturipe yella kala dolu yella vele yelu deva ninnane sturipe yella kala dolu yella
somewhere here, there's no
Do you need a Bible right now?
Oh, no.
Oh, we have it. Everything's fine.
We've been thinking about this unity of creation, unity of mankind, and finding its unity in this archetypal man, this Son of Man, the Logos, the Word of God. And now I thought we would reflect a little on the practical, the yoga, the way to this unity. Yoga means to unite, to yoke, and it's the way of unity, to integrate the body, the mind, and in the spirit, the total integration of the man and of man with humanity, with the creation. It's the total unification of being. And I mentioned, I think, that in the early school, the yoga was rather the separation, that you had to separate Purusha, the consciousness, from Prakriti, from matter. Consciousness got involved in matter, got distracted by the senses, the world around us. And you have to separate from that. Obviously, there is a movement of separation from that and reach that state of pure consciousness. And that was as far as the early yoga went. But gradually it was discovered that that was not sufficient, and the Tantra came as a means to integrate the body and the senses, the feelings, the imagination, the total person. And that is why the Tantra is so important and why it has such a wide influence today. Because people today are looking for that integration. Swami Muktananda, as you know, is one of the great exponents of that kind of yoga, tantric yoga. It's based on Kashmir Shaivism, very profound doctrine. And that is what so many people today are seeking, how to integrate the total person. And Tantra is that way of integration. As we mentioned, all these seven chakras, all the centers of energy, of psychic energy in the body, in the soul, have to be opened. They're supposed to be compared to lotuses. Each chakra is like a lotus, and it's turned down. And as the shakti comes up, the lotus turns up, and you open up your whole being gradually to this part of the spirit, which is descending and ascending. And that is important, that the two movements are one, the descent of the spirit into matter, raising it up, and the ascent of the energy of the spirit through the matter, through life, through the soul, and returning to the spirit. So we... total integration of the person and the cosmos has to take place, and that is the tradition of tantric yoga. But I'd like to go back now to the Bhagavad Gita, which has a very comprehensive method of yoga. Particularly the first six chapters are what is called Karma Yoga. As you know, Arjuna is faced with this battle of life, and Krishna, as we saw this morning, first of all calls him to go beyond the dualities, beyond this world and that, beyond you and your enemy and so on, to realize the unity of the spirit beyond. And then he teaches him how to fight, how to do the work. And his great teaching is you must do the work. It's the opposite of, there is a tradition in Hinduism, you see, where you separate from the body, you separate from work. And in many ashrams, many sannyasis, you're not supposed to work at all. You've got beyond that, and you're engaged in meditation and contemplation. And that has its own value. We mustn't reject these traditions. They respond to certain conditions. But I think more and more people today find that that is not enough. You need to integrate your body, your senses, your sexuality, your feelings, your whole person into this unity. And that is where the Tantra had its value, and that is where the Bhagavad Gita, and you see, it was a very special moment in the history of India, that the earlier tradition of the Upanishad, the discovery of the Brahman, the Atman, had been a way of sannyasa. If you wanted to realize Brahman, to realize yourself, you had to separate from the world, take sannyasa, and become a renunciate. And that was the way. And the Bhagavad Gita opened the path of transformation to all men and all women as well. And it did it in a twofold way. One, by the way of karma yoga, the way of work, and the other, bhakti yoga, the way of devotion. And the first six chapters are concerned with the way of work, of karma, and the next six the way of devotion, of bhakti. And what Krishna says to Arjuna again and again is, you must do your work, you must fight the battle. If you like that language, the battle of life. And we were mentioning, I think, you see, that in this matter of war and battle, our tendency is to project. Where we suppress anything in ourselves, we suppress the negative aspect in ourselves, we then project it on the other. So we have an enemy, or a person, or a community, or a race, or a nation, whatever it may be, and they become the enemy. And so we create that duality, that dualism. And on the other hand, when you learn to accept the negative aspect in yourself, accept the shadow, instead of suppressing it, then it becomes a creative force in you. It's able to be transformed. And the anger becomes a positive force. And the sex energy becomes this ojas, this energy which rises up in you, a force of love which transforms your nature. So the whole being can always be transformed. All the negative forces can be transformed into this positive power. And so the Arjuna, Krishna says to Arjuna, you must fight in this battle, but it's going to be an inner battle. Instead of being fighting with his enemies, you've got to fight the enemy within. And I mentioned, you know, there's a saying, a hadith, one of these traditions of Islam, Muhammad, which says the true jihad, the true holy war, is the war against the enemy within, you see, not the enemy without. And this is so meaningful for us today when we're faced with the danger of war on every side. We can only overcome that danger without if we discover the evil within and are able to transform that. And then we become transformed persons, transformed, make a transformed society. So Krishna says to him, set thy heart upon thy work, but never on its reward. Work not for a reward, but never cease to do thy work. And that's the first principle of karma yoga. You see, we do our work in the world, whatever it may be, but we're not attached to our work. We don't seek a reward. And you know, most people are working for a reward, for money, for a position, whatever it may be. And it's not necessarily wrong. Obviously, you need money, you need to support your family and so on. But it's what comes out again and again is the attachment, you see. You attach yourself to that reward, to the money, to the position, to your family, welfare, whatever it may be. And then you are in bondage. As soon as you attach yourself, you're in bondage. So work not for a reward. And that is, you know, a wonderful principle that whatever you're doing, you do your best and then you leave the result to God. It's no good trying always to think you think you've got to succeed, you see. You do what you can, but you open the reward, you don't seek a reward from it. And the test of it is this. If you succeed in something and you feel extremely excited about it and feel what a wonderful person you are, then that means that your ego is in your work, you see. And if you're very depressed whenever things go wrong and feel that it's all hopeless, then equally your ego is in the work. But just get rid of that ego and do the work, leaving the result to God, then you have you're detached. Then your karma, your work doesn't bind you. The old tradition was karma binds you. Your good works bind you, your evil works bind you. But the Gita says that any unselfish work where your ego is not involved not only does not bind you, but releases you. It's a way of liberation. And for many people, you see, to do their work in the world, in the spirit of total unselfish dedication, surrendering the results to God, that is their way to God, you see, their way to union. So that's a very, very important principle. And then in the next chapter, chapter 3, he takes it a step further. Don't seek any reward, leave the reward to God. Now offer your work in sacrifice. And sacrifice is a word that's lost its meaning for us. We think only the negative aspect. But sacrifice is sacrum facere, is to make a thing holy. It's to consecrate something, to make it over to God, you see. And every work has to be consecrated, has to be made over to God. Whether we're cooking the meal in the kitchen or working in the garden or working in an office or in a factory or as a professor or a student in a university, whatever the work is, it can be sacrificed, it can be offered to God, you see. You detach yourself from it, make an offering of it, and then it becomes holy. Just as I was saying with that grace we sang, Ayaham Vaisvanaro Bhutva, we offer the food we're eating in sacrifice to the Lord, and he accepts our sacrifice, consumes the food, and we are perfected then by that, you see, when we offer the sacrifice. So it's a beautiful thing where he says, thus spoke the Lord of creation when he bade both man and sacrifice, and the two went together. By sacrifice thou shalt multiply and obtain all thy desires. By sacrifice thou shalt honour the gods, and the gods will then love thee, and thus in harmony with them shalt thou obtain the supreme good. So that is the path, you see, the path of sacrifice. And this is very important that in the ancient world everybody understood that life had to be a sacrifice. You see, the Vedic sacrifice was the centre of the whole religion. And the idea was that the light, the power, the fire came down from heaven, was buried in the earth, and you rub the flint or the twigs together, the wood, and Agni, the god of fire, springs forth. And then you offer everything in that fire. You offer your whole life, and it returns to God. So everything comes from above, and everything returns. And that is to turn the wheel of the law, see, the wheel of Dharma, the Dharma Chakra. And sin is appropriation. You stop the turning of the wheel, you see. You appropriate. This is mine, I do this. This is my work, you see. Your ego takes possession, and then you stop the movement of the law. You stop the rhythm of the universe. You put yourself out of harmony with the order of the universe, with the Tao, you see. And that is what we all do to some extent. And sacrifice is the answer. Every ancient religion had this principle of sacrifice at its heart. And we've almost totally lost it, you see. The idea in a modern culture of sacrifice is that the word doesn't occur, does it? So we don't really think in terms. Every meal is a sacrifice. And you know, in India it's beautiful the way you should eat. You take a banana leaf, you don't need plates and things, and you put the rice or the food there. Then you take some water and you sprinkle the water around the food, and you purify, you make a space, a whole sacred space, you see, keeping out all the germs, evil things outside, making a sacred space. Then you offer your food in sacrifice to the inner fire, you see, to the Lord within, and he accepts your sacrifice and you're purified by it. So every meal is a sacrifice in that way. And every work can be a sacrifice, you see. Whatever you do, you can make the offering of it in that way, and it transforms you and it transforms the people you're working with and everything. It's the way, that is karma yoga, you see, the way to make your work holy and sacred. And he says, and this is very strong, you know, pleased with thy sacrifice, the gods will grant thee the joy of all thy desires. Only a thief would enjoy their gifts and not offer them in sacrifice. To take food, not offering in sacrifice, to be a thief, because the food belongs to God, to the creation, you see, to the whole universe. And you're appropriating it, and that is sin, you see, and that is to be a thief. And on the other hand, when you accept it as a gift of the Lord of creation and offer it, then you are made holy and you make holy what you're eating. The whole thing is sanctified, is consecrated, you see. So that is the second law. First of all, don't look for a reward, keep your ego out of it in that way. Then offer it in sacrifice, dedicated it to the Lord, to the transcendent, the one beyond. And then the next one is that you offer it in a spirit of bhakti, of love, of devotion. And this was, of course, a great movement in the Bhagavad Gita, that at this time, 3rd or 4th century before Christ, this movement, the Bhagavata movement, is called devotion to a personal god, to the Bhagavan, arose, nobody quite knows when, as I said, in the Bhagavad Gita, is devotion to Krishna, in the Svetasvata Upanishad, devotion to Shiva. But both are this devotion to a personal god by which your daily life is consecrated. A vast number of Hindus, it's the ordinary Hindu is a bhakta, you see, has a devotee, has personal form of God, and he offers everything in the spirit of love, of devotion to the personal God. And for Christians, of course, that is their fundamental worship and their way, really, to total offering everything to Jesus, giving your whole life to him. That is bhakti, that is devotion, you see. And that is the third path of this path of karma yoga. The offering everything in love and in devotion. And then the fourth one, you go beyond all that and you realize, I am not the doer. Ramakrishna always used to say that, I am not the doer. You see, you think, I'm doing this, I'm here, I'm giving a talk. You're there, you're listening to me, you see, but I am not giving the talk and you're not listening to me. There is one who is in me and one who is in you, and we are sharing in that oneness of him. He says, where does it come? Not sure that I can find it. This is a beautiful passage where it says, know therefore what is work and what is wrong work. the man who in his work, he translates this, I'm using Mascaro in the Penguin Classic, which is very good in most ways, but here it's rather weak. It's he who in his work finds no work, in his action finds no action, akarma karma, which the Chinese is wu wei, you know, active passivity or passive activity. And that is when you see, you surrender the thing and you realize it is the Lord is acting in me. See, I am not doing this work. The Lord is doing it in me and through me. And then your ego goes, you see. Then we become instruments. Then we become what we are. We realize ourselves in him and him in us. And that is the fourth stage of this karma yoga. So this is an extremely practical doctrine, you see. And Mahatma Gandhi took this as his guide in life, you see. He said once that in all the trials or problems of his life, and he had as many as any human being, he always found support in the Gita. It was his guide in life. And actually, you know, in his little room, you can go to Sevagram, the ashram near Nagpur, North India, and it's still preserved as it was, a very little simple little hut there, you know, and his seat and his little desk. And on the desk is the Bhagavad Gita, the New Testament, and the Quran. And all his prayer, you know, he always united the three. And he was trying to bring those religions together in India. But it was the Gita, plus the New Testament, especially the Sermon on the Mount, which were his whole guide in life. And that is what he tried to spread, this doctrine of detachment, you see. That is the essential word, that normally, whatever we do, we get attached to what we're doing, you see. We want to succeed, and our ego goes into it, and we spoil our work, you see. Whatever we're doing, once the ego gets in, you may be very efficient, doing wonderful work, and so on, but if your ego is in it, you're spoiling the work, and you make it very difficult for other people to work with you. These are the things that cause conflicts, you see, this egoism which goes into your work. And if you can free yourself from that egoism, surrender it all to God, then he works in you and he works in your companions, and things work themselves out. See, somebody else is there, and he's working things out for you. And that is the great thing, to go beyond to that point where you begin to see your life is being guided. You're meeting this person and that person, going here and there, and it's not accidental at all. It's all part of a divine plan, and you're flowing with the rhythm of that divine plan, you see, and that is the real purpose. And that is karma yoga, this work which totally liberates, you see. It's a way of liberation. Now, the next part is this bhakti yoga. And that is, as I said, devotion to a personal God. And here I would like to go over that a little again, because many people have raised this problem. In the Hindu tradition, you see, there are many gods, and you can choose your own God, your Ishta Devata. You choose to worship God under a particular form, Rama or Krishna or Murugan we have in Tamil Nadu, and Hanuman or Jiva or Vishnu. There are so many different forms in which you can worship God. And each one chooses his own form of God and gives his devotion. But the devotion always goes through the form to the one, you see. That is always very important. If you get stuck on the personal form, then that becomes a bondage very easily. You've got to go through that form to the one who is manifesting in that form. And in the Christian tradition, your Ishta Devata is Jesus. But you have to go through the human nature of Jesus to the divine, to the Word of God, you see. And some people get stuck at this human form, and then you get this exclusivism and so on coming. And that is a great problem we face, as somebody was mentioning, you see, that for many Christians, Jesus is absolutely exclusive. And they take all these statements, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but by me, and so it has to be limited to that particular human form, that particular human life and existence, and only through knowledge and that can we reach the goal. But as I was saying this morning, the human nature of Jesus is assumed into the divine, into the Word of God. And the eye of Jesus is not simply the eye of the human, it is the eye of God in him. And in that eye, in that person, salvation is found for all. And St. John particularly says the Word enlightens every man coming into this world. That one Word, you see, it's enlightening every man. And for the Christian, Jesus, the Word takes flesh. And it is a unique historic revelation. You see, for many Hindus, they will say whether Jesus really existed or not doesn't matter. Vivekananda said it, and many other Hindus, same with Krishna, same with Rama. They say he is a perfect symbol of God, the Sermon on the Mount, the sacrifice of his life. These are the things that matter. The historical Jesus doesn't matter. But that is omitting something essential, you see, because we're all historically conditioned, and history has a meaning. The human race is evolving in history. We're all involved in this evolution of the human race, and my own particular life, you see, is part of this human progress. And in the life of a great man, or a holy man, or a prophet, or Jesus, that life, that historic life, has a place in the plan of God, you see. So we can't simply wipe out the historic dimension. The historic has to be taken up into the eternal. Again and again, you see, it's not leaving these behind and going beyond. It's integrating the historic, the incarnational aspect of things, you see, into the divine, into the eternal. And that is the particular Christian perspective, that the Word was made flesh in Jesus, lived out that life, that historic life, that historic death and the resurrection, and that is a way to God. And that is the path the Christian follows. But he must not say, you see, that is the only way through the historic nature of Jesus, through the historic church and so on, but that one Word of God manifest in Jesus and present in the church is also manifesting in creation, in humanity, in the different religious traditions. So this question of devotion to a personal God, it takes these different forms, and I think each one, as I was saying, has to follow his path. You see, if you're a Hindu or a Buddhist, a Muslim, a Jew, Christian, whatever, you follow the path which you're given. And that path is coming from the Supreme. It's leading you through that personal form, that personal devotion towards the Supreme. But you must keep open on your path. You see, the danger is when you close in on your path. And many Christians, fundamentalists today, see, they think this is the only way, and they reject every other way, and they think that those who are trying to find other ways are simply creating confusion in the world. But this is a misinterpretation, you see, really, of the Christian tradition. And the danger is present in others. You see the Hare Krishna movement, for instance, that extremely fanatical very often now. And so, and Muslimism goes without saying, that terrible fanaticism. So that is the great danger today. We face in every religion a fanatical fundamentalism, you see, which thinks that it only has the one way and rejects everything else. And what we're asserting is this way of ecumenism, you can call it, that is universalism of openness. And I want to make it very clear, you know, that this is an Orthodox Catholic position. See, the position I'm holding is really an Orthodox Catholic position. I think it would be a terrible loss if we to think we can just leave out the institutional church and all the traditional Christianity and simply accept a mystical tradition. The church is open now, as it wasn't before, to this kind of transformation, this kind of universality. See, the Vatican Council was an extraordinary moment in the history of the Church. Until that time, there was a radical exclusivism. Only Roman Catholics could be saved, and so on, you see. And only the Roman Catholics who believed these dogmas and accepted them and the whole system could say they also would be lost if they didn't accept the whole thing. And that was the system which had grown up. And then at the Vatican Council, this transformation took place and this openness to other Christian churches, to other religions, and to the secular world, which had just been condemned before, you see, as world in sin. And now it was seen as the values of the secular world, the church in the modern world, is a great constitution. So a tremendous outburst has taken place, you see, and it's germinating and fermenting in the church all over the world. Wherever I go, and in Italy, I find as much as anywhere you find this new spirit present there, and in Rome, and wherever you go, that ferment is taking place, and the other is there also. You see, there are extreme conservatives among Catholics and Protestants who think that this only the exclusive way, everything is confusion, we hold on to the exclusive truth, that alone can save us. But that is a backward movement, you see, and it has no real future in it, and it's terribly dangerous because it's creating conflict and schism, you see. It's the danger which we face. But the other movement is growing in all the churches and is bringing us all together. And what is very important, the best theologians and the leaders in the church are following this path, you see. And that's what happened to the Vatican Council. All these bishops came and they didn't know a thing about this. But the Central European bishops had their theologians like Karl Rahner and Yves Congar and Chilavex and so on, and they brought this new theology into the church, you see, and the bishops had to accept it because it was so convincing in itself. And so a transformation took place and a new theology, a new understanding of the Catholic Church, of the relation with other churches, relation with other religions, relation with the world, all that emerged. But it's taking time to penetrate through all the masses, you see, and it's a ferment. But as I say, the leaders are following that path, and that is the path of the future, and that is where we link up with all these new movements in Buddhism and Hinduism, Islam. This is where we are, you see, at that movement of humanity opening itself to a new synthesis, a new understanding. So, as I say, I think it's very important that this is an Orthodox Catholic position, you see, and there will be variations in that, and some may go a little too far one way or another. But for me, you know, to be a Catholic is precisely that, that you're within a community where you get the imbalances can be corrected, you see. You're not simply on your own working something out, but you're working it with others, and a consensus gradually comes, and that is how truth emerges. We no longer say, we've got the truth and it's all fixed. We realize that truth is always growing. It's a historical process, you see. We're gradually understanding the mystery of Christ, the mystery of the Church, the mystery of the whole creation. And this is an evolving, a growing thing, and each one, as he advances, relates to the others, and so the whole thing grows into a unity. And it's a process of growth. And one of the beautiful things which the Vatican Council brought out is the Church in pilgrimage. Before, the Church was a citadel or a fortress. It was holding the truth and keeping everything else out. And now it's a people of God on pilgrimage, moving towards the truth, opening itself to the truth wherever it's found, and seeking the final fulfillment. You see, in community with the rest of the world, with other religions, with other Christians, you see. So that is where we are today. We're in that movement of openness. And that, as I say, is this where this whole question of bhakti, of devotion to a personal God, and we must respect the different devotions. And devotion is something very personal, isn't it? When you're devoted to Jesus or to Krishna or to Allah or Yahweh, whatever, that is something which engages you at a very deep level, an emotional level and a physical level even, and your whole person is drawn towards that. But that is the danger of keeping on the emotional level, you see. That is when you get fanatical, when you're simply emotionally attracted to your own God, your own tradition, and you reject the other. And that is where this criticism, intelligence, intellect is important, you see. As I was saying, some people think that the intellect is the great trouble, and science has produced all this materialism and so on, get rid of all that. But no, the scientific mind, the philosophic mind, the mind that sees differences, which differentiates, that mind is essential to human growth, you see. Otherwise, we remain in this emotional sphere, and we're imprisoned in it in the end. It's very wonderful and fulfilling in one way, it imprisons you in another. So we need to go through the rational order, you see, the scientific, the philosophical. We can't neglect any of those, but we mustn't stop in those, you see, again and again. As you go to a higher level, you mustn't stop in it. You must see that all this intellect, scientific, philosophical, theological level, is only one level of consciousness, one level of understanding, and we've always got to go beyond it into the mystical tradition, to the transcendence, you see. But again, the mystical tradition mustn't think it can simply do without the rational theological tradition and the ritual organizational. You see, I think the different religions have their value. To be a Buddhist, to be a Hindu, to be a Muslim, to be a Christian, is to belong to a tradition and to share in that, which is a total thing, you see. It engages your body and your senses, your feelings, your whole person is engaged in that. So to belong to that tradition is a great enrichment, and we have to open ourselves to it. But again, we mustn't stop, you see, in the tradition and be shut up in it. We must be open at that point to the spirit and realize how we go beyond. And I was saying to several at supper, the wonderful experience we've had recently, you see, where Hindus and Christians and Buddhists meet together, and on the doctrinal level we can argue with each other for ages, you see, and never reach an agreement. But we sit together and we meditate and we live together, and we discover that there is a unity underlying our lives, our thought, our whole religious experience. And that's a marvelous thing. That is happening all over the world. People are meeting in that way and discovering this mystical unity, if you like. So it's a reality, but we mustn't think that that abolishes all differences. You've got to, still the reconciling work has to go on. So we're always, as I say, on these three levels, the physical, the ritual, the external forms of religion, and then the psychological or the doctrinal level and the emotional, the devotional level, and then level of the spirit, which transcends all. But all three levels are part of this whole human growth. So that is this way of bhakti, of devotion, And, as I say, that's the normal way most people go through karma. Selfless work. Mother Teresa is the perfect example. You see, she's a karma yogi. She finds salvation, she finds grace, she finds God in service of the poor, of the rejected, of the destitute, and so on. And millions of people today, that is their path to God, unselfish service. And for all of us, to some extent, that is the path. And then this bhakti, this devotion to a personal God, whatever form it may form, as I say, we must always respect a person's devotion of that kind, but and not allow that devotion to become exclusive. And then that devotion to the personal God engages our emotions, engages our inner feelings, our inner person, and relates us to the Supreme through that person. And then the last six chapters are jnana yoga. That is the way of knowledge, of wisdom. And here again, I think it's very important to emphasize that this jnana yoga is the same as gnosis. See, the word jnana in Sanskrit, J-N-A-N-A, is the same word as gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S in Greek. And the G and the K, and that is this knowledge, and it's a transcendent knowledge, you see. Gnosis is that wisdom. And St. Paul again and again prays for his disciples that you may have wisdom and understanding in the knowledge of the mystery, you see. And that is Christian gnosis, and that is also this jnana, this way of wisdom. And it's very important, as I say, to see that there is a wisdom in Christianity because it's not been emphasized. You see, in India today, nearly all Hindus will tell you the Christian church is a great charitable organization, and they all admire it. We do wonderful work. We've got hospitals and schools and colleges, hospitals, orphanages, care for the sick and the poor and the destitute at every level. It's a marvelous work of charity, but they say that's where it stops, you see. But when it comes when it comes to bhakti or to jnana, it's the Hindus have it. And, you know, Vinoba Bhave, I don't know whether you know him, he was the greatest disciple of Gandhi. He was Gandhi's successor, took over the movement after Gandhi's death, and led it for 20 years or more. He died only last year. And like Gandhi, he made a study of Hinduism, Islam and Christianity. And he was imprisoned by the British many times, and it was a grand opportunity for studying another language and another scripture, and that's how he gained his knowledge, largely. And so he's written very beautifully on each tradition and an excellent book on the essence of Christianity. But even he said, you know, that we need to combine the best in each religious tradition. That is, we combine the charity of the Christians with the bhakti, the devotion of the bhaktas in Hinduism, and the jnana of the jnanis in Hinduism. So Christianity only gets the good works, you see, we don't get the bhakti or the jnana. But we must recognize there is this wonderful tradition of bhakti, of devotion in the Christian churches, and there is this gnosis, this sophia, this wisdom. There is a wisdom tradition. Very strong in the Greek fathers, who nobody, very few people know, you see, but marvelous tradition of wisdom in the Greek fathers, in St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, and Bonaventure in the Western Church. But it has been submerged, you see, to a considerable extent in the West, and particularly in the last century or so, where all this rational idea and moral and the social service has taken over, and Christians today are so much involved in social work, they give the impression that they are a social organization. But there is that contemplative tradition of wisdom there, and that's what we need to recover, you see, to bring about this wholeness. So that is the tradition of jnana in Hinduism. Now, the way of jnana is, of course, largely the way of meditation. And I mentioned the yoga has this eight stages, you know. I don't think I'll just mention them, for most of you are probably familiar with it. But it's very important that the first two stages of yoga are yama and niyama, and that is moral law. So all yoga is based on the moral law, not to kill, ahimsa, not to steal, austere, to preserve chastity, brahmacharya, which is more, it's a purity of heart, not to kill, not to steal, to seek the truth, satyam, and aparigraha, not to covet, you see, not to grasp at things at all. That's first base, which is all part of the Ten Commandments. And then the niyamas are more like the counsels, saucha, purity of heart, of body and mind, and sandosha, contentment, with good and evil as things come, contentment. And then tapas is a beautiful word, you know, it means heat originally. And when you sit to meditate and do yoga, you generate a heat. I expect you have discovered it, some of you. You know, in the Tibetan tradition, you have this duma, this inner heat, which can generate a tremendous power of heat within. And so tapas comes to mean all ascetic practices, but originally it was this, that eat. And then you get two very important ones. What is it? Svadaya. Svadaya, which means self-knowledge, but comes to mean meditation on the scriptures through which you come to the knowledge of the self. Svadaya. And finally, Ishvara Pranidhana, devotion to Ishvara, the personal God, you see. Though it doesn't take a very large place in the yoga, yet it is there. So that's your basis for yoga, you see, for your whole practice, your sadhana. Then comes the Hatha Yoga, the asana and the pranayama, I mentioned this morning, the position, relaxed and firm, and the breathing, regular, calm, and rhythmical. And then the four stages, you know, pratyahara, withdrawing from the objects of the senses. Don't allow your senses to be absorbed. And then now there's an important distinction here. You see, in the ancient tradition, it was rather withdrawing from the sense world altogether, pratyahara, often closing the eyes or half-closing them, and shutting yourself off. But many people find that is counter-effective, that it shuts you into yourself too much, you see. And so many teach another method, which is sitting in a quiet place by the river among the trees. You've got a beautiful place here, anywhere here, and harmonizing the senses. Don't cut them off and shut yourself in, but be in harmony with all the sense world, all the beauty of the world around you. So it's much more harmonizing the senses, you see, and harmonizing the feelings. And yoga can be translated harmony, really, of body, mind, and soul. And then comes dharana. And dharana is concentration. And that they say as the central moment that to concentrate the mind, to make it ekagraha, one-pointed. Because whenever we sit to meditate, our mind begins to move from one thing to another. And here again is rather important. In the old tradition, you try to concentrate on one point, some object outside. You can take a candle if you like, or you take some holy object, or a tree, or whatever. And you try to concentrate on that and keep all other thoughts out. But now many people again find that is counter-effective. The more you try to concentrate, the more all the other thoughts keep coming in. So many advocate today the opposite. Let the thoughts come and let them go. Just observe your thoughts. This is a very Buddhist method. Observe your thoughts, observe your feelings, observe your sensations, and detach from them. See, that is the point. Don't get into your thoughts, into your feelings, fear, anxiety, whatever, and let them take possession. Observe your anxiety, your fear, your hatred, your resentment, whatever, you see. And then it loses its power. You detach from it. You become what is called a silent witness. You're looking on at yourself. And that is wonderful practice, because you can go on during the day. You begin to observe how you're getting angry, you're getting depressed of this, you see. You're no longer a slave to your feelings and so on. You've got a place beyond. You're detached from them. It takes time, of course. One's got to be very patient, because it keeps coming and going all the time, the thoughts and the feelings and so on. But as we go on daily, and I would emphasize, you know, if we want to meditate, it must be done daily, regularly. It's important not to break it, if possible. Every time you break your practice, you go back, you know. Whereas every time you continue it, it builds itself up. You may not notice at the time, but gradually you'll find that something is building up within you. And that is what we see. So dharana is this method of one-pointedness, of gathering at the point of the buddhi, you see, beyond the manas, it goes from one thing to another, to the buddhi, the point where you're, the still point, you see, where you're in the presence of God. And then comes dhyana, which is meditation proper. As I was saying this morning, that is crystal contemplation. Dhyana, you see, is transcending the senses and the feelings and the mind, and focusing on the one, you see, and they compare it to a steady flow of oil. Your mind flows in that direction, you see, flows with the reality itself. And finally, samadhi is absorption into the ultimate reality. You're no longer well, there are two stages of samadhi. There is samadhi with seed, where you're still aware of yourself and the object, and the final stage, seedless samadhi, when you totally lose awareness of yourself and are absorbed into the object of your meditation, God himself, whatever form it may take. And there's some very important sayings of the fathers which have exactly the same point. They say you are not praying as you ought as long as you know that you're praying. See, as long as you're conscious of yourself, as an ego self praying, you'll not reach the point where you've gone beyond, and you're only aware of the one, you see, that. So that is the traditional eight limbs of yoga, and they're still very practical, you see. And they remain, I think, a basis for any religious tradition, really. You can follow that pattern of yoga. So Now, then there are various practices which go with this, and one of these is fasting. Somebody asked me about that. And the Bhagavad Gita, in the end, last chapter, has quite a lot on this question of food. And in India, this is considered very important. You are what you eat. Your food makes you, you see, makes your body is you. And there is no doubt you are deeply influenced by the food we eat, you see. And they divide, you know, into the three types, the sattva, the three prakriti, nature is said to have three gunas, three strands, three, what do you call them, three...
Gunas.
Gunas, yes. English word.
Aspects.
Aspects, if you like, yes.
Qualities.
Qualities, yeah. One is tamas, and tamas...